after COVID, we ended up seeing about 45 to 60% of the population that qualified for mental health needs and services. So it's a big jump. And I think people who are living with chronic disease and have co-occurring depression and anxiety just makes it even harder.
Welcome to the Redox Podcast, where we explore the intersection of healthcare and technology with some of our industry's most notable contributors. I'm your host, Nico Skivaski. In my day job, I'm the co-founder and president of Redox, where we're on a mission to enable the frictionless adoption of technology in healthcare. We started the show to share what we're learning and hopefully allow you to skip some steps as you embark on your journey through making healthcare a little bit better. So without further ado, I welcome you to the Redox Podcast. My guest today is Stephanie Telenius, the founder and CEO of Vida Health. She founded Vida in January of 2014, right around the same time as Redox, by the way, after a storied career in Silicon Valley, which we're going to get into. Since then, Vida has raised $83 million, including a recent $25 million round in April, and has, according to LinkedIn, nearly 500 employees. Vida is a mobile continuous care platform for preventing, managing, and overcoming chronic and mental health conditions deployed at Fortune 500 companies and large national payers. But I'll let her tell you about it on today's episode of the Redox Podcast. So your resume is quite interesting, having worked at eBay, PayPal, Google, Kleiner Perkins. Healthcare is a notorious difficult space. I'm really interested in what made you go from a background in digital consumer products and investing into this space that's fraught with landmines.
Well, it's fraught with opportunity as well. So I had both personal and professional reasons. So the personal side of it is that my dad had multiple chronic conditions. He was living with diabetes, obesity, CHF, COPD, and depression. And I was really struggling with how to help him. And I noticed that there was really no mobile solution for day-to-day continuous care for chronic disease. There was no remote patient monitoring or coaching or help with medications or compliance or explanations for how to handle these conditions and the different medications he was on. And so I just was surprised that there was like everything else in my life was on my phone and it was so easy in shopping and buying food or clothes or taking care of travel or anything I needed for my family. It was always there. And I couldn't believe that healthcare was so behind. So it really came from that personal need to try to solve a problem for him. And then when I started looking into how backwards healthcare was, I realized that there was an opportunity to really help a lot of people. And like my dad's really not very unusual, unfortunately, in the United States. So there's like 147 million people living with chronic disease. So that's really where it came at. And I realized that I could take the skills that I had learned at eBay and Google and scale, you know, products to millions of users in commerce and shopping and apply it to healthcare. So that's really how the company got started. And now, of course, we're a much bigger company. We have we're actually a licensed provider in 50 states. We have 900 providers in our network. We have digital therapeutic programs for prediabetes and diabetes and hypertension and depression, anxiety, et cetera. We cover both physical and mental health. And we're scaling and growing really fast this year. And we've got about 1.9 million covered lives.
Oh, wow.
And it's actually really rewarding during a time of like a global pandemic, you know, when you're working from home and everyone's sort of sequestered, to be able to help other people. And when you see the impact on people who are living with chronic disease, the impact of COVID is quite stark. I mean, the likelihood of them getting more sick with COVID or being hospitalized, like 90% of the people who've passed away from COVID had an underlying chronic disease. 78% of people who are hospitalized have a chronic disease. So being able to help people both with chronic disease as well as mental health, now that we're all working from home and there's a lot of uncertainty around the economy and how the pandemic's going to play out. Of course, a lot of people are losing their jobs. And so people are, managing their kids on Zoom at home. And so it's a stressful time. So mental health demand has also gone up, and we have a therapy network in 50 states. So it's been fun, to serve people and help during this time and do something that where we're focused on helping other people.
you take care of patients with chronic conditions and mental health. Did you start with both of those things, or was that kind of an expansion later on?
Yeah, we started with chronic disease and cardiometabolic syndrome and knew that we wanted to go into mental health, mostly because I had seen it with my dad, but I also just had read all the data. And then what happened is in the first year, we literally had 30% of our coaches and providers saying they couldn't treat the diabetes without treating the depression. Oh, so it was very clear that we had to move even more quickly into that area. And that they were completely interrelated. It's almost the physical and the mind and the body are one.
Yeah.
And we've known that for a long time in healthcare, but we still tend to treat them in a siloed fashion.
So how do patients actually get a hold of your product? It's not direct to consumer, right? Like how does one get onboarded? And then what do you do? What does your platform do to actually help the patients? Just to kind of walk through the workflow so we understand at a tactical level what's happening.
Absolutely. So we are a B2B2C company. So we sell to large employers and payers, I think like a lot of other companies in this market. And when we provide the service to employees, it's generally free. So they would see marketing on campus or through email or through, you know, some kind of campaign that we did or the company did marketing our service. They would go to a web link, download the app. Most of our users are mobile, though we have a web product as well. And they would engage with, they download the app and they can pick an area that they want to focus in. We also get eligibility and eligibility files with claims and RX data, so we can actually do real-time eligibility and match people to the right program. So everyone comes in and gets a digital therapeutic with a coach or a therapist, depending on if their severity. And they also get devices sent to them. So we ship cellular glucometers and blood pressure cuffs and scales and all those things to people's homes. So it really depends on what program they're in, but we customize it and we create a very personalized longitudinal relationship with them. And our goal is really to reverse all the symptoms associated with these chronic diseases. And they, you know, in the case of diabetes, we will take them off their medication if we can. We'll get their A1C down to below 6, and you know, we'll get them in a place where they don't need to be on insulin or oral meds. And if they have hypertensive meds, we'll take them off those as well. So that's the end state, and to really manage the conditions on a day-to-day basis so they're not really affecting your life and you're happy and healthy. And they may, you know, you may have underlying predispositions for these chronic diseases, or you may have underlying root drivers that could always flare up, but that, you know, the way you're managing the conditions, you're in check and you don't need medications. And so your productivity at work is great. Your mood is great. You feel great. Your biometrics are great. That's the goal.
Yeah. And you mentioned that a lot of that increase in demand has come from the need to treat people who are suffering from some kind of stress or anxiety or depression related to COVID. Do you think that the uptick is mostly related to the mental health needs, or are you also seeing an uptick from a chronic care perspective?
It's both, because individuals who are living with diabetes are worried about getting COVID and how to avoid getting the disease, but also if you get it, how to make sure you can essentially live through it very quickly, have it pass and not have it impact you or your organs or anything like that, and have, you know, any kind of severe reaction. So they're really trying to optimize their management of their medication, their nutrition, their lifestyle, their sleep, their stress, their immune system. They just want to make sure they're in a good place. So that's chronic disease. And on the mental health side, there's just an increase in stress, depression, anxiety across the workforce, people having their loved ones getting sick or worried about the economic implications of COVID, or, you know, managing their kids on Zoom at home and trying to give them a great education at the same time that they're not really able to go to school. So there's just a lot of stress, and you're seeing burnout a bit too, because people are working longer hours. I think people are feeling pretty productive at home, but they're also dealing with their whole family and the stress of managing that. So there's just a lot of dynamics, and we're seeing increased demand from all of our employers and payers to serve the mental health issues. And what I find most fascinating is when we work with large payers, we get claims data so we can tell who's been coded for depression or anxiety. And when we take in those files, they're typically in the population, you'll see sort of 1 in 5 that have anxiety or depression. And so it's generally between 17 and 20%. When we did the PHQ and GAD surveys this time after COVID, we ended up seeing about 45 to 60% of the population that qualified for mental health needs and services. So it's a big jump. And I think people who are living with chronic disease and have co-occurring depression and anxiety just makes it even harder.
I've observed you talk about mental health and chronic conditions as very much related. When VITA actually approaches solving those problems, are your coaches looking for both of those things, or do you have kind of different coaches and different providers for people who are dealing with mental health versus, you know, diabetes, for instance?
We administer a lot of different tools inside the app and questionnaires to really get at the right care that we need to provide. And then we provide differentiated service lines depending on the severity of the individual. So if they have a higher PHQ, which is a score for depression, and they have a higher severity, they definitely have a therapist. And we have therapists in 50 states. And all of our programs have some kind of underlying cognitive behavioral therapy or behavior change methodology, but everyone's also trained in motivational interview. But it really depends on the acuity of the individual and their different conditions as to whether they have a coach or a therapist.
So employers purchase VITA as a benefit for their employees. And the idea is that by reducing the burden caused by these chronic conditions and mental health problems, the healthcare costs will actually be lowered for the employer and the workforce will be happier and more productive. That all makes a ton of logical sense. How do you actually measure the efficacy and show ROI to those customers?
It's a great question. Everyone has to demonstrate that in this market. And so we have done studies. We will analyze claims data. We'll look at medical cost savings over a period of time. And we do measure ROI. And when we look at the cost savings that we can achieve for the various cohorts of patients and then look at the cost to serve as well. We've seen a point reduction in A1C for people living with diabetes in about 6 months. We've seen a 76% reduction in stage of hypertension from stage 2 to stage 1, for example, or stage 1 to 0. We've seen a 7 to 10% weight loss and over 50% reduction in PHQ and GAD, which are the scores for depression and anxiety at 6 months. In fact, we just published a study in JMIR on our mental health outcomes for depression and anxiety, which shows, you know, long-term retention and reduction of PHQ and GAD scores, which are, again, depression and anxiety measurements.
That's amazing. If you fast forward to today with you helping your dad, would this be the product that you'd love to use with him?
I would have loved to have had this. Yes, I would have shipped them the devices and given him a coach and a therapist and had him manage his health completely differently. He was on a lot of medications and he really didn't have the daily guidance or support he needed.
In order to access this, you have to have it as an employer benefit. Is there a way for patients directly to interact with this? Because I just imagine so many people are dealing with this and, you know, could be hearing this and saying, I want that. Is the best way to do it like to ask their employer?
And the best way is to have their employer or payer cover it. You know, I think that what we've seen in the digital health market is consumers kind of expect that diabetes, hypertension, some of these chronic diseases are covered by their insurance plans. And so sometimes we'll get emails from consumers that says, I have this plan, is it covered? Mm-hmm. Can I get VITA through this plan? So I think, you know, because we have over 150 million, I think it's 160 million people living here in the US with their healthcare coming through their employer, then they expect these things to be covered. So that's why we sell to employers and insurance companies marketed directly to their members. So that's generally been the focus of the company, is to do B2B2C. And I think you see that across the board with a lot of digital health companies.
As I mentioned, Redox primarily supports vendors who have a value proposition for healthcare delivery organizations, hence the need to integrate with their EHRs. Selling to health systems is known for being this two-year gauntlet where you have to convince 100 people to say yes, and any one of them can say no and crush your deal. I'm really curious about vendors who sell to employers. What is that sales cycle like? Is it similar? Where are the bodies buried? What are the landmines to watch out for?
Selling into payers and employers right now is also affected by COVID in some ways. The payers are looking for a digital platform like we have. They're looking for a way to engage with their members. And they have higher and higher costs, and they're concerned about medical cost savings. And so we help them with those, you know, with those polychronic patients that are living with hypertension, diabetes, hyperlipidemia, depression. So I think the payers are even under more pressure now. And then employers are looking for solutions while everyone's living at home and working from home. And there's an increasing burden from mental health. So they want to help their employees avoid getting COVID. And if they have chronic disease, certainly helping them if they stay safe and make sure their immune system's strong and they're ready to go if they get COVID, so they're prepared. And then on the mental health side, there's just an acceleration of demand for mental health. I think it's the number one request by most employers right now to try to help their population. So I think you're seeing COVID really change the sales cycle a bit. And then of course, there are organizations that are so overwhelmed managing their workforce and all the changes that are going on that they're really focused on that as opposed to doing anything new. So there's lots of different dynamics right now.
One of the things I've been thinking a lot about as the pandemic has reared its ugly head in our healthcare industry is that it's almost like the nexus of power has shifted from health systems, you know, the academics of the world, the IDNs, because of the lack of utilization of those traditional care settings, the move to virtual, all of that, the nexus of power has kind of shifted more towards payers because with the lower utilization, the payers are sitting on more cash right now. They're worried about not meeting their medical loss ratios. Do you think that that shift has also increased demand from payers in buying products like yours to help kind of directly interact with patients and basically move more towards actual patient care and not just the risk side of it?
They are able to look at medical loss ratios and invest more in digital health, which is a great thing. They're looking for medical cost savings as they always have. But I do think that there is, with the move to telehealth and the growth in telehealth during COVID, I mean, you know, telehealth was essentially single digits and then as a percent of total visits, and then it went up to like 60%. And then now it's gone back down, and I think everyone thinks it's going to settle around 25 to 30% post-COVID. But with that growth in telehealth and with all the changes that CMS introduced, making telehealth visits and digital therapeutic interventions and reimbursement for virtual care equivalent to in-person care, that has fundamentally changed the approach that the payers have taken. And everyone is now everyone had to move virtual. So virtual care has just really taken off. And so has the need for payers looking for virtual care solutions, looking for digital therapeutics and platforms to help their members.
Do you think the idea with that parity with reimbursement was that we're going to reimburse at the same rate, everyone has to move virtually, and so hopefully we'll change the behavior of both patients and providers to be comfortable in a virtual environment, and then eventually they'll kind of bring that reimbursement down, but the behavior change will stick? Like, what do you think will be the long-term implications of that regulatory change?
I do think the behavior change will stick with consumers once they've had the experience. They realize how delightful and convenient and productive and really outcomes driven telehealth can be, then they'll stick with that as opposed to having to drive and have a 7-minute visit and, you know, not have that continuous support through virtual video. So I think once consumers have tried it, they'll stick with it and request it from their payers. And once payers have realized the cost savings, they'll stick with it as well. So I really believe that COVID has been an accelerant for the whole industry.
Yeah, it's like the unfortunate catalyst we all needed to.
Yeah, it's sort of the silver lining of the pandemic in some ways.
I noticed that Vita closed a round in April, and your prior round was just 10 months earlier. Was that latest round in response to the pandemic and the uptick in demand, or was that kind of in the works already before?
It had been in the works, so it wasn't just driven by the pandemic. Uh-huh. We knew we were going to grow a lot this year. We had signed contracts, and the pandemic has accelerated utilization on our platform, no doubt. And I think on many, you know, many cases, you're seeing just an increased demand for virtual care at large.
As telehealth saw this huge spike in demand, many investors are kind of bearish on the market, calling it commoditized and just a feature. And it seems like a lot of telehealth companies really need to evolve to bring in outside features specific to disease states. What are your thoughts on that? And, you know, certainly that's what Vita is doing with this, but how do you think the telehealth market is kind of evolving with this huge shock to it?
Well, I agree with the statement that, like, over time, I think the notion of having a telehealth visit through text, audio, video will become very standard, maybe commoditized, as you put it. What I think you will see is that the intersection of the product with the telehealth, with the follow-up and the care on an ongoing continuous basis is really what matters. So what we combine a digital therapeutic evidence-based program with remote patient monitoring through devices with the telehealth, and then we use machine learning to analyze how you're doing and predicting what your outcomes are going to be, and then intervening throughout the experience to make sure you're going to hit those outcomes. So it's really the combination of those things that I think differentiates products over time. Just the telehealth visit is one component of the whole service.
So one thing that I keep kind of thinking about, and I'm not sure necessarily how to ask this question, so I'm just gonna try it, and we'll see if it makes any sense at all. You know, I come from the healthcare provider world, you know, hospitals and health systems, and there's been this slow movement towards value-based care, to use a very generalized term, but essentially taking on more risk, becoming more like a payer or more like an employer who takes risk on their employees, right? And essentially, it's kind of, imagine a spectrum. They're on the right side, kind of moving left towards risk. What I find really interesting is we also have payers who, in a traditional sense, are just the sort of financial mechanism of paying for these claims that providers are submitting. But what you're helping them do is kind of move right from that financial perspective into actually caring for patients. And so it's almost like this middle state in this spectrum is where, you know, incentives are aligned, right? The folks who are taking risk are also the ones who are paying for the care, who are also the ones providing the care. And therefore, the bottom line, the profit maximizing position, is actually really great for patients and the most efficient way to deliver care. Are you also seeing a trend from payers into providing more direct healthcare services? Where do you think that's going? Is that something accelerating, or does that make sense at all?
I think I understand your question. I think you're getting at is a really important long-term trend that we all have to see in healthcare, which is moving to a value-based construct where we're providing the right care at the right time, and that we're not essentially, you know, over, you know, providing too much care to any one individual, and we're doing the right things for them on an ongoing basis to make sure that we manage their condition. So we tend to have this very reactive healthcare system where we react too late, and then we put people on medications or they have to have surgery. And I think we need to move, you know, forward and have a much more ongoing, continuous care approach to chronic disease and mental health in particular, so they don't exacerbate and get, you know, build up and to become something that's just so difficult to manage. And along with that, I think what you would see is that you would allow physicians to practice at the top of their license, and you would allow coaches and therapists and others to practice at the top of their license. So you essentially create this value-based construct where you have like an integrated care model where the physician does what they do best, the coach does what they do, the digital therapeutic does, and the devices do the rest. And so you're lowering the cost to manage patients over time, and you're creating a financial model that makes sense where everybody has incentives to do that. And so I think you're seeing lots of movement in that direction, both by large hospitals and large payers as they expand. You know, United, for example, Optum is buying a lot of different providers and building out their provider practice. And I think large accountable care organizations are both kind of a hybrid between a payer and a provider. And that's increasingly becoming the case. And so we have had this discussion about moving to value-based care. I think it's happening. It's probably not happening it's always like every innovation where it feels like it's not happening fast enough, and then all of a sudden you'll wake up and it'll just be the standard. So
yeah, it's,
we're there yet, but we're getting there.
It's interesting because, you know, as I talk to, and, you know, as Redox works with vendors who are helping providers kind of, you know, manage chronic conditions and take on risk in this way, there, it's a lot about helping the, like, health system repurpose their existing staff, their, you know, their clinical staff and employees to think differently, think, you know, not think in a fee-for-service world, but kind of use technologies to take care of a panel of patients and figure out who's at risk and intervene earlier on. Whereas on the payer side, you know, they don't have their own, you know, providers. So like VITA has to come with your own kind of packaged clinicians,
right,
to work with patients. And so it's almost like more of a blank slate to start from, it seems.
I think that's true of a lot of payers, but a lot of payers are also building out provider practices or partnering with provider networks and building a value-based construct where they're creating financial incentives for the physicians to, you know, to do more with the payer. So I think you're starting to see a lot of movement in different directions to try to get at this value-based model.
So in that regard, is there ever a conflict between the providers that come with VITA and the providers that are already out in the community that a payer might want to utilize for the same purposes?
That's a great question. We haven't seen that conflict yet. Typically, what happens is we bring our platform and our providers, and the payers can use our platform, which they like because they need a digital platform. And typically, the payers we've been working with have care concierge or care navigation at the very top for the single digit percentage that drive a lot of costs in the system, but then they don't really have services that go below that. And so we're very complementary to their own care navigation or concierge services.
Mm. How do you work with PCPs and, you know, other providers that have relationships with patients? Do you share data with them, or?
We do share data with them. We do share, and we have care navigators as well that will connect back to, or we have pharmacists who will connect to the PCP and help people get off their meds. So we do connect back to the PCP. And I think that's where you're seeing, you know, I think a lot of payers are also building preferential kind of provider networks. So we're happy to work with those as well. So I think you're seeing innovation across the board where people are aggregating providers trying to have this more value-based construct.
I like how you said working with PCPs to help patients get off their meds rather than to kind of update the PCP on new meds that you might be introducing.
Yeah, we also do help with medication adherence. So if somebody is not, you know, is having issues, but yes, in general, we're trying to take them off their meds and improve their health.
That's almost a side effect of a fee-for-service world, right? Where, you know, meds are an easy and profitable thing to prescribe rather than kind of the hard work of you know, really digging in and hitting the underlying root causes.
Yeah, I think that's what I was referring to up front in terms of our healthcare system. I think we need to move to this proactive, continuous care model as opposed to reactive.
Yeah. Cool. Well, this was really fun. I appreciate you kind of bouncing around with me as I realize I ask questions from left and right and center all throughout this. But it was awesome getting to know you a little bit and learning more about VITA. If people want to learn more about it, can they reach out to you or reach out to the company? How should they get in contact?
Yeah, they can just email me at stephanie@vita.com.
Nice. Awesome. Well, thanks so much. And I appreciate you being on.
It was great to reconnect and talk to you again today. Thanks. Appreciate you taking the time.
Certainly. Thanks a lot. Well, there you have it. That was Stephanie Telenius, founder and CEO of VITA Health. Thank you for listening to our show. If you liked it, be sure to leave us a review and drop some stars. If you didn't like it, don't do any of that. Shoot us an email at podcast@redoxengine.com with any feedback, comments, suggestions. We love to hear from you. I have a fat stack of more episodes coming out soon, so keep an ear out. And thanks for listening to the Redox Podcast.